I'm speaking today with Mark Sardella, professional engineer who's dedicated his life to finding and disseminating solutions to some of the most complex issues we face today, including climate instability, resource decline, and adherence to an outdated competitive economic model. Mark installed the first solar power system in the state that was legally permitted to upload electricity to the power grid. And last October, he was invited to Russia to present on the intransigence of the power grid. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Mark.
Thank you, Zaylee. Great to be with you.
Can you tell me a little bit about the title of that presentation, The Intransigence of the Power Grid?
Sure. Well, intransigence, you know, to be stuck on an extreme position and unwilling or unable to move off of it. So where is the power grid stuck? The power grid is stuck in the 1960s. You know, not only is the technology and the architecture of the power grid 1960s technology-based, but even the hardware being used in the power grid is from the 1960s. You know, most coal-fired power plants were built during a time that you and I were in diapers, you know, and those same power plants are still in operation today. About half of the electricity in the world today is generated by steam turbine generators that were built in the 60s, and the efficiency is incredibly low. This is the primary problem we have with the power grid. It's stuck in the 60s and won't seem to move off it.
Now, we won't really accept outdated technology for anything. I mean, we buy a new Mac every few years, or we have a new cell phone. Not that we have to, but we really expect development and evolution. So what's happening here?
Well, it's an enormous feat, actually, to prevent a technology from evolving. You know, as you say, all technologies evolved. When these steam turbines were built for the power plants, we were using rotary dial telephones and typewriters. Who would do that today? I mean, you literally can't do that today. So it was an amazing feat to keep us stuck in the 1960s, and the fact that they've continued to do it, to tell you the truth, they've continued to do it through telling a series of lies that they've been telling for years about that's the only way to do it, it's the most reliable, it's the most effective way to do it. And fundamentally, you know, the power grid is so polluting. I think people don't realize how important it is that we end this intransigence, because the pollution of the power grid is unbelievable. The electric power industry, as an industry, emits more toxic pollution and greenhouse gases than all other industries combined. Now think about that. One industry more than all the others combined. Think about some of the most polluting industries you know. Paper, plastics, chemicals, refining, agriculture. Enormous amounts of greenhouse gas emissions. If you add all those emissions together, you don't get as much toxic and greenhouse gas emissions as you do from the electric power industry. It's a staggering fact, and it's the number one thing we have to address if we're going to address climate change.
And a number of that is inefficiency you were talking about before.
Yeah, it's really amazing. You know, when we talk about the power grid and trying to get it to evolve, almost all you hear about is solar and wind. You know, everybody wants to look at the really sexy stuff. It's really interesting to put solar panels on your house, or to build a utility scale solar, or to have wind turbines up on the ridge, you know, outside your community. That's all really exciting. It's really interesting. But by and large, the number one problem is the generation side efficiency that utilities are still producing our power with is so low that they waste twice as much fuel as they need to. In fact, you could almost say three times. Let me give you an example. If you burn coal in a power plant that's 30% efficient, which is roughly what these coal-fired power plants that still dominate the energy landscape are, if you burn at 30% efficiency, that means you put 100 units of fuel into the boiler and 70 units get thrown away and only 30 units get delivered to the consumer. Now think about that. Every time you hear a discussion of efficiency in electricity, it's always about you and your light bulbs and your weather stripping. You know, you left the light on when you left the bedroom. How dare you do that? You're working on this tiny little bit of electricity that got delivered to you. If you add up all the electricity that gets delivered and double it, that's how much the utility throws away as a waste product. It's absolutely insane to throw away two-thirds of your fuel at the front end and then expect everyone to conserve on the back end.
And all of this toxicity being thrown up in there, I mean, is this also impacting climate change, heat trapping, or is it a different kind of waste at this point?
No, that is exactly what's happening. When you burn 100 units of fuel, you get the 100 units of greenhouse gas emissions. You get the 100 units of nitrogen oxides, of sulfur oxides. You know, you get all the pollution. You know, think about all of the environmental problems you know of today. They're almost all caused by electric power. You know, you're only allowed to eat a can of tuna fish every month or something now because the fish are so toxic with mercury. How did the mercury get in the fish? I got bad news. It came out of a power plant stack somewhere. You know, and the same thing with greenhouse gas emissions. Again, you know, as an industry, far more dirty than all the other industries added together. We must address it, and we must address it with efficiency. I wish it was sexier. You know, everybody likes to talk about the sexy side of power. You know, solar panels, electric solar panels. I am an advocate. I think it's a great idea. 40 years since the launch of electric solar panels, we have 1% penetration in the market. 1% of our electricity in this country comes out of a photovoltaic panel. Wind energy, very sexy, great big development. I mean, huge strides made in other countries. Denmark now has something on the order of 40%. I mean, really interesting technology. In the U.S., 3% penetration for wind technology, and all you hear about is how it kills birds. Give me a break. Electric power, the last time I saw an analysis, electric power plant pollution kills between, I think it's now down to about 12,000 Americans a year die an early death from breathing the toxic pollution of power plant stacks. It used to be the old studies, back when power plants were dirtier than they were today, if you can imagine. The old studies showed about 30,000 deaths a year from electric power. So give me a break on a few birds. Give me a break on that these technologies aren't ready for market. There is a major reason why these technologies have not gotten penetration into the marketplace, and it is the intransigence of the electric utilities.
So let's start getting to the root of this. I heard you give a presentation recently, which was, it was fabulous and incredibly alarming. Let's talk a little bit about, we can use our local example, though as you said before, this is not a PNM bashing because all utility industries pretty much act the same way.
That's right.
Let's talk about cogeneration. What is it, and what were some of the attempts to make more efficient energy plants?
Sure. Well, efficient generators, you know, as I say, the electric power industry is using highly inefficient generators built in the times in the early 60s, or in the mid-60s, really. There have been more efficient electric generators out, certainly available commercially since the 1970s. And the typical ones are called cogeneration. The first thing you need to look at is what's called cogeneration. Co meaning together. And the things that come out of this generator together are heat and electricity. Now, typically when you burn a fuel like gas or coal, which is, you know, 2/3 of our electricity is still burning gas and coal or coal, you know, about a third of the energy will come out of that process as electricity. The other 2/3 of the energy comes out as heat. If you utilize that heat, either to run back into another generator and make more electricity, or to utilize a process heat, utilize that heat to heat homes or buildings, any way you find to recycle that heat, you can easily double the efficiency on the generation side. Again, that technology has been around since the 70s. In the early 80s, there were cogen companies springing up all over this country. And in fact, there were projects, cogeneration projects going in. And a cogeneration project works like this. If you go up to a facility like a hotel, take any of the large hotels in Santa Fe or in Albuquerque or any of the hospitals that use a tremendous amount of heat for washing clothes and sheets, for heating the spa and the swimming pool, any facility that uses a lot of heat is a candidate for cogeneration. This did not go unnoticed by the engineers that were running around in the 1980s. And in the early 1980s, there were a number of companies, there were about five in northern New Mexico, running around to these big clients, going into their facility, saying, you know what, I've analyzed your heat load and your electric load, and you could save a ton of money by installing a little on-site generator and capturing the waste heat to heat your swimming pool, to heat your hot water, to heat your rooms, you know, for clients and so on. It was pretty simple to show that these customers could save a lot of money, but after years of trying to get any of these cogeneration systems installed in Santa Fe or in Albuquerque at any of the big hospitals, not a single system had gone in. And that is a tragedy, and it was due to the direct influence of, as you say, all utilities, but we do have examples here in New Mexico of our utility. PNM would go into those clients facilities and convince them not to sign contracts with these cogeneration companies.
So let's go into that, the kind of strategy, how this happened, and why cogeneration has not flourished.
Well, it's fantastic. I mean, first of all, the reason behind it is pretty simple. PNM is a centralized utility. They spent an enormous amount of money building these nuclear and coal-fired power plants. I understand that. They built these power plants. They wanted to make money. They invested a lot of money for a long term. They wanted these plants to run for a long term. All of that is understandable, but you know, the fact is they overbuilt and they knew they overbuilt. The fact is they gold-plated and they knew they gold-plated. And the reason they were doing that is because the type of regulation used, you know, PNM is a regulated monopoly utility. So when they go into the regulation company, in front of the regulation commission, they have an agreement called cost-plus regulation. This is what was used back then. It's still used today. The more money they spend on a project, the more money they make on a project. So if they invest $100 million, they get their $100 million back from ratepayers, and then they get to keep the asset. You know, so let's say they're guaranteed a 14% profit. That's what it used to be. I think it's slightly lower now. So if you're guaranteed a monopoly utility and you're guaranteed a 14% return on investment, you spend $100 million. You get $114 million back. Then they give you the asset. That's 214% interest. You know, so it's not just that they make 14%. They also get the asset. Then they get full control of the asset. And they get to depreciate the asset. And if you do anything to lessen the value of the asset, which came up later, these are arguments that come up later in our discussion, I think, then they get to collect for the diminution of value of the asset. So being an electric utility is an incredibly profitable thing to do. Now, how do they hold on to this gig they got? If you had a gig that returned 114% on your investment, you'd hang on to it too. I don't blame them for any of this. I do, actually, but that's a different story.
Exactly.
And we will. You'd hold on to it too. And how do they hold on to it? They hold on to it by controlling the terms of interconnection. So all of these more efficient things we talk about, like cogeneration, solar, wind, geothermal, biomass, all of these things, you know, they don't operate standalone. They can, but that's very difficult to do. The best way to utilize these technologies is to connect them to the power grid and make them a part of the power grid. So now instead of a power grid that would be highly centralized, you'd have a highly decentralized power grid. Well, PNM doesn't want that because the centralization of power is kind of a literal term. You know, you're not just talking about centralizing the architecture of electric power. When you have control of the power system and it is centralized and you are at the center of it, standing at the controls, that is a very powerful position by definition. So you don't want all these little generators hooking to the grid. So here's what PNM would do. They would go out to the customer site where these cogeneration companies had already gone in and told these people they could save money. And they would convince the customer that they weren't going to save money. They'd say, well, you know, we have all your electric and heating bills for all these years because we've been your supplier. So the truth is we've analyzed them also, and this guy is way too optimistic, and you won't actually make money by spending on this cogeneration. They're underestimating the cost, you know, the maintenance cost, the downtime, and furthermore, we're not sure we're going to be able to provide you stand-up and backup power should your generator go down. And if you do want us to provide it, it's going to be very expensive. So they had all kinds of ways. They used their monopoly power to twist the arm of these companies and get them to not sign contracts with these cogeneration companies, despite the fact that these customers would have saved a ton of money signing on with the cogen companies.
So purely lying, or was there any kind of truth to these investigations?
You know, Zaylee, the best lies are the ones that have a little teeny hint of truth to them. So yes, almost entirely lies and a tiny bit of truth. One of the other tricks, they had what they call an arsenal. The internal memos on this are fascinating. You can read inter-office memos inside of PNM. And it's fascinating. They call what they have an arsenal of tricks that they go in with. The first one, as I told you, is they tell the customer that the economics isn't going to work out. Then they start withholding backup and standby power, you know, the things that they can do. And then if none of that works, they had something back then, and this is the one they really got in trouble for, or almost got in trouble for, I should say. They had a way of offering a special deal on electricity where they could go into that customer and say, you know what, we've shown you that it doesn't work and you're still going to do it. We've shown you that your electric and your standby charges are going to go up and you're still going to do it. I'll tell you what, we'll give you a special rate. We'll cut your electricity price by X percent in exchange for an agreement not to sign with this cogeneration company. And by golly, you believe me, that got their attention. When they could go in there and say, you don't even have to do the cogen project. We'll just pretend you did it, and you can pay us the money that you would have paid the cogenerator, and we'll cut your electric rate to whatever the savings would have been, and you don't have to deal with the hassle of maintenance and calling in a repairman when you need it or dealing with this cogeneration. Yeah, they had what they literally referred to in internal memos as an arsenal.
Can you talk a little bit more about some of those memos and the idea of the alien? I loved that one, though.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. They were so into stopping these cogeneration projects. And again, you know, be aware, this is a for-profit industry. This is a competitive industry now. The U.S. government, through the FERC, was trying like crazy to get these cogeneration systems installed because they offered such advantages over central, inefficient, dirty power. And, you know, despite those things, PNM was wielding its monopoly power to shut these things down. And they would go in, when they would go out to customer sites, they would go in there, and if a cogeneration company had already been in there talking to them, they would call that laying an alien egg. And they considered their job to go out and spot these alien eggs. And they called themselves, this is really interesting, they were part of a group inside of PNM called Cogeneration Planning. Now, interestingly, that's what they were called on paper. If you looked at the organization chart, these were the Cogeneration Planning Group. Well, were they planning on cogeneration being installed? No. They were planning on cogeneration being deferred. They were counting on cogeneration being stalled, being stopped. And they called themselves, loosely, in memos, in interoffice memos between engineers and their bosses, the cogen busters. They were laughing and giddy, and they were the cogen buster groups. And I remember one particular memo, interoffice memo, this fellow had just gone out to a big sheetrock plant down in Bernalillo. You might remember that sheetrock plant right on the road with the big plume of steam pouring out. That's a clear indication that there's heat going on inside that building is all that steam coming out. So that was a big potential for saving a ton of money on cogeneration. They went in there, found that the cogen companies had already been there. That was the alien egg. And then when they managed to stop it, he wrote to his boss, this particular engineer from PNM wrote to his boss, hey, it's rare that the cogen busters can go out and find two alien eggs in one day. Apparently he'd been to two sites in Bernalillo where the cogen companies, and his boss was so excited, you know, good insight, you know, I'm really glad you found those. And he said, let's make sure we squash this egg.
Squash this egg,
yeah,
which is innovation, which is...
That's right. This is the kind of stuff that will get you in trouble should you ever be cited by a court for interfering in a market that's not yours. Again, PNM has a monopoly in something very specific, and that's the provision of centralized power through their big centralized power plants that they had oversight, that the regulators had oversight of. Cogeneration was an unregulated, competitive business, and they were wielding their monopoly power to squash an unregulated competitive enterprise.
Can we tell the listeners a little bit why you have these interoffice memos and where this information comes from?
Well, sure. These cogen busters did a terrific job over a period of years, about 3 years now. These cogen companies were running around trying to get cogeneration systems installed at the big loads so that these customers could save money. After a couple of years, after about 3 years of running around trying to convince people to install these systems, they noticed that they had not sold a single system. You know, it's the kind of thing that doesn't really go unnoticed. So these guys were hurting for money. Some of them were being driven out of business. Some of them were merging together. It was just an ugly time for the cogeneration industry. Interestingly, we say that all these utilities were doing that. I don't think any utility in the country was squashing these cogen systems the way PNM was, as well as PNM was. I think there was only one cogeneration system installed in the state. There were thousands of cogen systems going in around other places in the country.
Okay.
Still not very many, because a lot of them were being squashed. But PNM was starting to give interviews in technical journals talking about their ability and their success at squashing these cogen projects. And that is probably the thing that sunk them. After 3 years of these competitive enterprises trying to compete with PNM shutting them down, one of them finally, in July of 1988, filed in district court in Albuquerque against PNM for restraint of trade and monopolistic practice and antitrust under the U.S. Clayton and Sherman Antitrust Acts. It was an amazing lawsuit because, you know, first PNM denies doing it and they ask for a dismissal. The judge does not grant a dismissal. Then the cogen company files what's called discovery. I want to see if they really had a program inside of PNM designed to squash me and my friends and my fellow cogen companies that were trying to do this. It turned out PNM did have that. PNM turned over 125,000 pages of documentation, and within that, you know, pouring through that with this one particular fellow, he owned a company called Energy Productivity Services, EPS, and that was the cogen company that filed suit. He and his team of three attorneys ran through those 125,000 pages of documents and found internal documentation demonstrating that clearly PNM was acting outside their regulated purview and squashing a competitive industry. One of the most interesting things, I've read a lot of those memos because I now have them. I went down to the federal courthouse and got a copy of the case. One of the most interesting things that comes out of reading those memos is PNM, you might remember, you've been in Santa Fe a while, PNM used to own both the gas company and the electric company.
That's right, yes.
And while the gas company was giddy with laughter, as I say, over this this ability to squash these projects, the natural gas division of PNM, not so happy about it, because these represented new clients for them. A cogeneration facility burns a tremendous amount of natural gas. So these were representations of big, big sales on the natural gas side. PNM, interestingly, in terms of conflict, PNM board of directors and PNM owned a lot of the gas wells. So they owned natural gas wells that would have actually, you know, had a bigger market to sell into. And they were, you know, the guys who owned the gas wells were a little conflicted about shutting down these cogen projects as well. So you find internal memos in PNM talking about the conflicts. You know, one of them on the gas side was between two engineers in the cogen group. And what he said was, you know, so far the bustle of activity for years now has not resulted in a single cogen project. So it's just a testament to the effectiveness of the PNM program for shutting these systems down.
So they have this documented.
Oh, yeah, it's fascinating. And, you know, it's not just the documentation of the internal memos at PNM, which are scary enough. They interviewed, they deposed, is what you do in a lawsuit now. They deposed many of the managers at PNM to ask them about these programs, and they deposed the owners of these cogen companies. And the cogen companies, in separate depositions, pretty much all told the same story. Yeah, I took my client, you know, to the point that he was ready to buy the cogen project. We walked into PNM. You know, I walked him in there because we needed an interconnection agreement. Now imagine this. You're the cogen company, and you're the client, and you need to go to PNM now and get permission to interconnect your cogenerator with their system. So what was PNM doing? They'd go to these interconnection meetings, and PNM would not only argue about the interconnection terms, they would argue about the economics of the system at large. The story was the cogenerator and the company official would go into PNM. There would be 10 PNM engineers sitting around a table, and there'd be a stack of computer printouts, analyses sitting on the table, and PNM would throw one analysis after the next on the table, demonstrating that the cogeneration system was unfeasible or uneconomic. Then, if they got past that portion of the meeting, then they would start with the, I don't know, I'm worried about that. You're going to need a $10,000 relay to make sure that our system is protected from your little cogenerator. Now, these cogeneration systems might have been 40, 50, 60, 100 kilowatts, tiny, tiny generators compared to the power grid. It's very difficult to hurt the power grid with a teeny little generator. So a lot of these claims were unfounded and were known to be unfounded, again, because by the internal memos, they were just using their arsenal of tricks to shut down, to cogen bust.
So what was the date of the filing of this case, and then what happened? Tell us more about it.
Yeah, fantastic. The case got filed in July of 1988, and this fella, Chris, with his team of engineers, fought for almost 4 years just in pre-trial hearings, introducing motions to quash, motions to compel. You know, one thing after the next, PNM was throwing back at them, and it took almost 4 years before the judge looked over at PNM from the bench and said, you know what, I think we're going to call in a jury here. There looks to me like there's enough evidence to take this to trial. As soon as he used the word jury, PNM raised their hand and said, we'd like to go to the settlement table. So the PNM, the judge, ordered them to settlement. And they went and they sat down at the settlement table. And I'm not sure exactly what transpired, but you know what legal fees cost. And if this fella had three attorneys on payroll for 4 years, yep. I suspect he had millions of dollars in legal fees. He was probably in debt up to his ears. P&M probably offered him millions of dollars. The settlement is sealed. It's the only thing that is sealed about the case. He won't tell, and you can't get him to tell you how much money he took, but he took a tremendous amount of money in order in exchange for he would stop. I'm not sure what the gag order was. I think he just wasn't allowed to tell how much it was. But he withdrew his complaint, and the case settled 4 years out. So that's how it went. P&M was never convicted of an antitrust crime. I have talked to Chris Perry. He tells me that 25 years after this thing happened, he still regrets taking that settlement.
He does say that.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But given that, he certainly was not the only co-generational outfit who was put out of business or was challenged. So did anybody else pick up? I mean, after all this discovery was done, the information was out.
Well, no, interesting. You know, all these other companies, I'm sure, thought of that. Now all the discovery's been done. The case is laid out. All the documents are available. You can just pull those and re-enter them in a new lawsuit. Why didn't these other companies go back and also sue P&M? Well, I think the answer is P&M, now having not been convicted of a crime, went to the legislature. And they got a state law passed making it legal to cogen bust.
Oh, my God.
And the argument they used to do it was, you know what, we built all these coal and nuclear plants. We have so much excess production. Because back then, they had overbuilt. They had gold-plated everything so that they could make more money. They had overbuilt. They had all these power plants sitting in reserve, all this extra capacity. And their claim was, you know, it would be better for ratepayers if we didn't build more generation through these cogenerators, if we just sold, you know, out of our capacity that's sitting in storage. That would be better for us.
It's basically the same kind of BS that they told the cogenerational, that will actually make them, right.
Oh, the stream of BS does not stop.
Okay.
Yeah, no, the stream of BS is long and deep. So,
yes. I hope we can say BS on the radio.
I hope. Can you? Well, it's the implication that you can't say. So they convinced the legislature. Now, they've not been convicted of a crime. They convinced the legislature to pass a law called the load retention rate. And that load retention rate gave them the right to negotiate in secret any deal for anyone at any time if there was a threat that that customer was going to leave the system and generate on their own. So that's the law we've been under ever since, the load retention rate. I don't know who has a load retention rate. It's the case file is empty. We went to the commission years ago to say, I want to see those load retention rates, how many have been filed. And they just looked at us and said, oh, that case file is empty. The case file is empty. There has not been a single bit of oversight by the state. Now, bear in mind, oversight by the state is the thing that keeps you from being convicted of an antitrust lawsuit. If you have oversight from the state, you can claim that your monopoly was sanctioned and was overseen by the state. They made me do it. Again, none of these load retention rates have been overseen. We actually had one instance in which I don't think it was on the record with a reporter present, unfortunately. We asked the chairman of the Public Utility Commission years later, tell me about who's got a load retention rate. We want to know how many of these are out there because we think they're unfair. And he looked at us, literally said, I don't know what you're talking about. What's a load retention rate? Now that is a demonstration that there has been no oversight of this practice of offering load retention rates.
Now there was another aspect in this, in the new legislation. I mean, it's basically the evolution of legalizing corruption, legalizing monopoly.
Right.
So within that, there was also another law that you had mentioned the other day, the belief. Talk about that. If they believe.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. Well, again, the main thing that's going on here is we have not had evolution of the power grid. And evolution, we all know what evolution of the power grid looks like because around the world, a couple of places, at least, they have evolved power grids. Evolution looks like connecting many, many more devices to the power grid. Not and erase everything you've heard or thought about smart grid because that's a ruse as well. Yeah, all we're talking about is connecting many, many distributed resources to the grid, generators, load management systems. What you have to realize is the reason you can't do that in this country, the reason it hasn't taken off in this country, is because utilities maintain exclusive control over interconnection to the power grid. So if you want to put in a solar power system on your house, you're going to spend $20,000, and you're going to sign an interconnection agreement. And I guarantee in that agreement, in legal effect, are a set of words that make the following claim. PNM has the right to disconnect any system at any time, at their discretion, at your expense, with no recourse. So your $20,000, let's say you have to go get a loan for your $20,000 solar power system. And the bank says, sure, we'll give you a loan for that as long as it's going to pay back. Is it going to pay back? And you say, well, I think it's going to pay back. Well, is there a way that it might not pay back? Well, PNM can disconnect it at any time for any reason with no recourse. Now, do I think PNM's going to do that? No. Have they done that? No. Because solar, again, is not a threat. Cogeneration, however, is a huge threat, and they have done that over and over again. So again, what...
They have disconnected?
No, they have threatened to, okay. And you can scuttle a project by threatening to. If you threaten to at all, you can't get financing. These cogen projects, some of them were multi-million dollar. So you can't get financing for a multi-million dollar project if your competitor can cut your wire anytime it wants to.
For any reason.
So again, now, you know, it used to be done on this sort of onesie-twosie basis, and again, PNM went and got a state law. I've never read a statute. I'm not a lawyer, but I've read a lot of law. And I, there is an actual New Mexico statute. You can look it up. And it reads like this. If the utility believes that anything connected to its system... What does the word believes mean? What is this belief? Yeah, I've never seen the word believes written in law, but we are in New Mexico, so here we go. If the utility believes that anything connected to its system may be problematic... What is may... I can't even say, may be problematic.
It's about as vague and arbitrary as...
According to whom? Well, yeah. What kind of problems are we talking about? If the utility believes anything may be problematic, it can disconnect it and send a letter to the owner telling them why they disconnected. There's nothing in law about recourse. There's nothing in law about the person who was disconnected coming back and making some kind of an argument. If the utility believes it may be problematic, it's disconnected, and that's final. And that has been used to scuttle the financing, certainly, but to scuttle pretty much any attempts at decentralization in the state of New Mexico.
So when we talk about all of these solar projects and why don't we have them and we're the land of sunshine, this is really the issue. It's not about a lack of money or the batteries don't hold it. I mean, there is no innovation because somebody in charge does not want innovation.
Yes, restraint of trade. It absolutely is restraint of trade, antitrust. In fact, if you looked deeply enough into it, it's conspiracy to deceive. Because as I say, and conspiracy to deceive, you may remember, that's what brought down tobacco. Conspiracy to deceive is when they sit in a room and they think about and they cook up strategies by which to restrain trade. It's not... What lies are they going to tell the public, in other words, to make sure that this commerce doesn't take place? So...
Well, this is incredibly depressing, and in the short time we have left, what can people do? And is there a way to actually look at the legislation and to change that and to say, wait a minute, this is not legal, this is antitrust?
Absolutely. Well, the way I look at it is this. You don't solve problems until you understand problems. So running around trying to put in a few solar panels to get a few wind projects, to get the utility to run an efficiency program, you're looking in the wrong spot. We've been looking in the wrong spot for years. It's time to look directly into the face of the beast. The problem is you have a monopoly utility that's so incredibly powerful that they are able to maintain this position and maintain these lies that anything other than the way they're doing it would be unsafe, would be too expensive, and would be unreliable. Remember who the electric companies are. The electric power system is incredibly valuable. It's incredibly important to modern society. And in New Mexico, we have a lot of military bases. PNM is the supplier to Sandia military, to Kirtland Air Force Base, to Los Alamos National Labs, even though Los Alamos has a municipal utility over there, actually. But PNM is the supplier, you know, on the transmission system that runs up there. So, you know, the utility system is incredibly important to our security and to our modern way of life. So these things don't just change overnight, but you have to change them ultimately. You have to modernize them because the central power system is so inefficient and unreliable. You know, you haven't seen it be unreliable, but it's becoming less stable as investment, you know, less and less investment in transmission. So we have to modernize it. We have to move it off this position. And if we're going to do that, we have to address the core problem that the utility controls interconnections and it controls generation. So you'll never get this incredible array of distributed generation you need until you take away control of the wires. My belief is, and this argument's gone on in utility regulation for a long time, you can't have a single entity owning the wires and also owning the generation. That's what creates the monopoly that's so powerful no one can bust it. My belief is that all of the wires need to be a public asset dedicated to the public good. And that's been done in countries around the world, the most notable being Denmark. If you think about your highway system, you know, the power grid is a highway for electrons. It's a highway for this electrical power. You know, you have to have the highways be a national asset. You can't allow them to be a for-profit asset in private hands. So seize the grid, take it away, make it a public asset, guarantee fair and equal access for all New Mexicans or all citizens, and then open the market. That's how you can open the market to competition, and we'll see the modernization that we haven't seen for the last 50 years.
And are there people and groups right now in Santa Fe and New Mexico working toward this goal?
In Santa Fe, for sure. I mean, when you hear the efforts for municipalization, that is exactly how you start doing it. All of the problems that I'm talking about with this monopoly power go away if you take the grid away and make it a public asset. And that's what municipalization of utilities will do. What you want to municipalize, really, again, is the wires. And Santa Fe has the right of condemnation as an incorporated city to seize those assets, to negotiate the price, and to take them and dedicate them to public benefit purposes. I believe it's imperative that they do so, because otherwise the future of this community is at the mercy of a for-profit entity. And again, we've been using the acronym PNM a lot. It's not PNM. You know, who owns PNM? Who is PNM? It's all owned by investment houses. It's owned by stock conglomerates. It's owned by insurance houses. You know, this is an investor-owned utility, the key word investor. We're not talking about mom and pop with a retirement account. I'm sure some of that exists. But predominantly, by and large, these big utilities are owned by investment houses that care about nothing but return on investment. They don't care about you and your community. Has to be taken out of their hands. Our future has to be taken out of their hands.
I have been speaking today with Mark Sardella. We're going to be taking a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be speaking with Cindy Chavez from the New Mexico Breastfeeding Task Force and Cheryl Gilles-Poulin, New Mexico Breastfeeding Promotion Manager. So, Mark, thank you so much. This is a very important conversation.
Thank you, Zaylee.
Thank you for being here.